Our next case is Herman, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Horst versus Bill's Diesel Repair and Thompson Gas LLC respondent, A20-1604. As all parties are aware, the appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent's counsel will have 15 minutes and appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This argument is being orally recorded. I simply caution counsel and the parties and anyone watching that court rules prohibit any private recordings. So you'll able to be hear the transcript of this tomorrow, I think, on the Court of Appeals webpage live, but you can't do your own recording. With that, counsel for the appellant, please begin and just tell us again who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
My name is Sharon Van Dyke, and I am here on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant, Herman Horst. This is a workplace accident that works under the workers' compensation law in a third-party defendant action, which is something provided for by workers' compensation law, and runs into the Comparative Fault Act, which has many tensions with the Workers' Compensation Act, as I think this panel and everybody else who works in this area well knows. This case is the footnote from Fish. Fish was the most recent discussion by the Minnesota Supreme Court about how the conflict between Workers' Compensation Act and the Comparative Fault Act in a situation where you have to dip outside of the Comp Act into the Comparative Fault Act because you've got a fault, you have a fault-based tort action, actually a tort-based action against some other party who is outside the system. Fish involved similar facts to this in terms of what's important, which is a jury allocates fault within the tort lawsuit between all the parties, including the employer, who has no possible liability to the plaintiff. In Fish, that all worked out, and the court didn't have to deal with what happens when the plaintiff has less than 50% of the fault, therefore is entitled to recover in tort against somebody, at least under the way the wording of the statute is now. And yet the third party defendant within the comp system, and I like to call it the outside tortfeasor rather than the third party tortfeasor because it gets very confusing. When that tortfeasor under strict tort rules and a strict construction of the Comparative Fault Act, as that act has been interpreted over time, would give that no liability. Liability being something that's cited outside of the Comparative Fault Act. I think we tend to think of it as being decided by the Comparative Fault Act, but the reality is all the Comparative Fault Act asks the jury to do is to decide who's at fault. And Lambertson says, who's at fault and how do you apportion that fault? This is footnote 3 in Fish. Because if this were a pure tort action and there was a third party tortfeasor that had potential liability to the plaintiff and the plaintiff had either sued both defendants or the defendant Bill's Diesel had brought them in, then the legal conclusion drawn by the district court with respect to is Bill's Diesel liable to the plaintiff would be, their position would be correct. The answer would be no. And that's because of Lyon v. Ryan. That's because of how the law has been interpreted over the years, the comparative fault law. But in this situation, our position is that workers' compensation law is the boss here. We have to stay within it because the right to
Ms. Van Dyke, I'm still struggling to I was kind of hoping you'd get to the gist of your argument, but let me just cut to the chase. You referenced footnote 3 in the Fish opinion.
Yes.
But that just references the comparative fault act and that a plaintiff can recover as long as the fault of the plaintiff is not greater than the fault of a third party tortfeasor. That seems to be the case here. And given that, it seems to be that Cambern applies. Fish does not address Cambern at all.
Correct.
And that footnote is only a reference to the comparative fault provision. It doesn't construe it. It doesn't overrule it. It doesn't say it doesn't apply. Why doesn't Cambern apply in this case and bar recovery right from the very get-go? Why isn't that a bar right from the very get-go? Because plaintiff appellant's fault here is greater than the third-party tortfeasor.
I understand that the defendant's position is that Cambern applies. The Comparative Fault Act has changed enormously since the time that Cambern was decided. And the underlying premises of Cambern, which were joint and several liability, much more heavily common law tort. It was decided in another time, in another circumstance. In Fish, you've got language that says, that accepts the fact that these cases fall outside of the tort system, except for this little foray into it, and that they should be treated differently. In eliminating, basically what the court said was 4.02 subdivision 1 simply doesn't apply. My position is you can't tear that statute in half just because what used to be one statute, one number, became two, and that 60402, it doesn't apply, but neither does 60401 in the sense that, not in the sense of the jury deciding fault allocation, but in the sense that the judge then takes that allocation and decides what the law is. Fish talks about the fact that it referred to Hudson, which was what I call a hybrid case, because Hudson permitted contribution when there, under the rules of tort, there would have been no liability at all on the part of the employer. And basically moved right past that and allowed contribution anyway, applying tort principles, but not strictly enforcing them in terms of what contribution would have required under the then existing Comparative Fault Act.
I'm still not following your argument though, counsel, because that footnote 3 in Fish says, quote, here the district court applied Minnesota statute 604.01 in submitting the verdict form to the jury, and that decision is not at issue in this appeal.
There was absolutely
Fish talks about 604.02. Fish does not address 604.01. Those are two separate and distinct provisions. And 604.01, by its plain language and as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Cambern, explicitly says a plaintiff cannot recover if the plaintiff's fault is greater than a third-party tortfeasor. So I guess here's my question. What case law, I don't read Fish to overrule or overturn 604 Cambern, it doesn't even address it. And it certainly is not interpreting 604.01. So can you point to any other case law that specifically says Cambern is no longer good law?
No, there isn't any that I could find.
So we should follow Cambern then.
This is an intermediate appellate court, and I don't see case law that addresses the issues that I'm talking about. The same way when Lambertson came through, you couldn't address it either. I can't tell you that you have the authority to address Camber and use the principles in Fish and in Hudson Body and overrule Camber. And what I'm saying is, my position is that what the Supreme Court did in Fish and the 2003 amendment, which Fish interpreted, the 2003 amendment to the comparative fault law, has made a sea change of difference in how workplace accidents are handled and the results that take place when you apply 604, anything in the Comparative Fault Act, and when you apply the Lambertson principle, whether you want to call it through Lambertson itself or whether you want to call, you know, go strictly to the codification of it. There is no case law to answer your question. This may be the case law. I have to go, this is the path I have to use. And I frankly think that the 2003 amendment to the Comparative Fault Act and Fish's re-emphasized discussion about the fact that the comp system is superior in the comp setting and that the Comparative Fault Act, although we borrow principles from it, doesn't necessarily always apply rigidly and strictly. And there are other solutions to this problem that stay as closely as possible within meeting the requirements of both acts. And this is one of them. To answer your question, I think I did. There is no case law I know of. Here I am making my pitch, knowing that you have an obligation to apply the law as you see it. And I have an obligation to request that people look at the fact that maybe other things have changed the law and Camber needs to go.
So Ms. Van Dyke, how do you square your position with Hudson, where there were three third-party tortfeasors? Judgment was entered against the two whose percentage of fault were greater than the plaintiff's, but not against the third whose percentage of fault was less than the plaintiff's.
Hudson, I was using Hudson for a different principle. Hudson was applying the Comparative Fault Act at that time. Hudson was post Lyons v. Ryan, which frankly is the oil and the water in the oil here when it applies to workers' compensation. And I don't think there's a disconnect between Hudson and what I'm asking this court to do. Hudson followed tort law where it felt it had to follow tort law and didn't follow tort law where it felt that comp law was different. And that happened to be with respect to the contribution claim that was with 60402. It did not happen to be with the determination of liability based on fault allocation. And Hudson, joint and several liability was still the law. When the legislature removed joint and several liability from the equation in 2003, that works quite well for what they wanted to do with respect to three car accidents or other non-employment scenarios. It frankly increases the conflict and tension between tort law and comp law. And Fish was a perfect example of that. I think analysis of Hudson, if it were to be run through the 203 amendment in terms of joint and several liability, all the pieces kind of fall in different places. And you'd have to rethink how it was done. With respect to the tort, all of the tortfeasors were treated within the tort system, and that's what the law says to do with them. The only actor who should be treated differently in our position is the employer. And whether or not the Supreme Court would want to take actions like Hudson that had three regular tort, third-party tortfeasors and an employer and put them with it, where they'd want to put that in terms of the legal effect of comparative fault. I can't answer that one. But I think that what's the deal with the employer and the employee and a third party defendant? I think that's the nub of it. And however many third party defendants there are doesn't change it. Because obviously I'm advocating that the unit rule, if you will, how you interpreted the word person in 60401 for the purposes of liability, that's going to be hit square on the head, and that is Hudson. Hudson dealt with that. That's what I dealt with.
Thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. I just wanted to say I thought your brief was excellent, and I thought you had me until I actually took out a calculator and compared the numbers in this case and Fish, and that's kind of where you lost me. But I guess either way, however we come out, would you recommend we issue a presidential opinion in this matter? It seems to be covering an issue that really hasn't been decided yet. So what's your thought on that?
I think you're completely right. It's an issue that hasn't been decided yet, which is why I had no direct answer other than no for Judge Reyes.
Okay.
It might be easier for you to go with what you think the law is stretched to a little bit if it was unprecedented as opposed to precedential, but I think that's your call.
Well, I'll certainly share your thoughts on stretching the law with my colleagues during conference. We'll see how far we can stretch it without breaking it. With that then, your time is over. We'll now hear from Ms. Orcutt, counsel for the respondent. You may begin, please.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Paige Orcutt, and I represent respondent Bills Diesel. We're here today because Bills Diesel was found 5% at fault, and the appellant was found 45% at fault. And when you apply the clear statute, Minnesota Statute 60401 sub 1, and precedential case law such as Camburn v. Sioux Tools, the appellant takes nothing, judgment is entered in my client's favor, and that should be the result here that's affirmed. Today, I want to talk in a basic three-part framework. First, that there is this clear statutory and case law authority for what the district court decided for judgment, and this court should affirm. Second, that Fish and Ramler didn't touch 60401. And in fact, in a footnote, footnote number 3, as Judge Reyes pointed out, discussed this issue. And third, that our position will ensure that this court doesn't mandate that aggregation is now the standard in tort law.
You know, Ms. Orcutt, I had one question for you, and I apologize for not letting you go further. But do we really have to get to any of this? Why can't we just say, appellant's counsel at trial, you know, didn't object to the instruction, didn't object to the special verdict. Who cares? It's all waived. And that way we avoid these momentous, complex insurance comparative fault issues. Why can't we do that?
Good question, Your Honor. And we did brief this in our written brief. My short answer is that there is this fundamental plain legal error doctrine out there, which appellant courts have taken up issues before that counsel hasn't objected to. It's not typical. It's generally that you need to object to preserve your right to the appeal. But if I may jump a little in my notes here.
But you'd like a presidential opinion going your way, right?
Interestingly, Your Honor, no.
That's a first. Okay. So you want a non-presidential opinion going your way in the hopes that the Supreme Court will simply not see this case?
We believe, Your Honor, that this court, this case is well within the precedent. Camburn v. Sutools discusses what happens when a plaintiff is more at fault than the party they sue. Hudson also impacts the, or discusses the idea that the plaintiff sues the tortfeasor, the plaintiff does not sue the employer. So I do want to answer your original question. The invited error doctrine, I do think it's a gateway for that opposes the appellant bringing up this appeal, but I also recognize that appellant courts are willing to grant review when they see that a fundamental or plain error has happened. I do not believe that a fundamental or plain error has happened. I also believe this case is well within the precedents, and the opinion that this court may issue and should issue in our respectful request is well within the law. It's applying the plain statutes to a tort case. It recognizes there's not this insurmountable ravine between workers' comp law and tort law, at least as far as this narrow issue. It also treats injured workers, employee tort plaintiffs, the same as a regular tort plaintiff. And I think that's a really important policy to keep in mind here. The benefit—
I think Ms. Van Dyke's essential point is we shouldn't, because it is a little different. And up until Fish came down, you know, I would have thought, you know, employee was out of luck as well. But it seems to me the Supreme Court does have some language now that, you know, these types of cases are a little different. So maybe we should ignore the fact that even in this case, you know, Mr. Horst was 45% negligent. Because we are interested in sort of, you know, and I can't remember Ms. Van Dyke's words, but, you know, getting the full amount from that. Well, I don't know, perhaps I'll just say evildoer, third party.
Oh, no. Oh, no, Your Honor. No, I think that we do treat employee tort plaintiffs better than our tort plaintiff as it relates to this contribution claim, because the courts created contribution and then the legislature took that and put that into a statute. We've had, I think the last 20 years, we've had the ability for the legislature or the Supreme Court to address that comparative fault in its entirety should not apply in workers' compensation law when they step into the tort arena. And we haven't had that. So this court would be taking quite the, I believe, different avenue than what the legislature and the Supreme Court has decided is palatable for this specific issue. I do agree with you that the employee tort plaintiff is treated differently, but what's being requested today is such an important difference. Now, all tort plaintiffs are not on common ground together. So we would ask that the comparative fault 604.01 be applied as it should apply, because you've got no authority to say it shouldn't. And the policy reasons or the logic behind it doesn't seem to follow. If I may, I'll jump back into where I was going. So we talked about the pure statute and the Camburn versus Sutools. I think this court has a good grasp on those facts. In Fish v. Ramler, which Judge Reyes discussed, footnote 3, that case, if we look at footnote 3, the court there talks about the district court applying the statute, reducing the damage award. I would argue that tells us that the Supreme Court approves of that. Now, they didn't have to. They just said that's not an issue here, so we're not addressing that. So first of all, Fish v. Ramler, not really helpful for this case. If it is at all important for this case, it's to showcase that that type of a reduction per the statute is acceptable. Yes, does Your Honor have a question?
Yeah, I don't know if we can really read into what the Supreme Court says about it. I think you're trying to characterize it as Supreme Court is citing to it approvingly. I'm not sure we can read it like that. I think the Supreme Court is just saying, as it often does, we're not getting to that issue because that's not before us. This is a related issue, but that's for another day. And I'm speaking for myself, but I read that as we're not opining one way or another, whether we approve of it or not, or whether or not it applies, but because the parties didn't raise it, we're not going to address it. So that seems to be the issue that is indeed squarely before us right now. So why shouldn't we issue a precedential opinion that says one way or another, either your position that Camden and the plain language of the statute should apply, or say, you know what, Fish is indicating that this really shouldn't apply in this type of situation, as Ms. Van Dyke is advocating. Why shouldn't we issue a precedential opinion one way or another, just to clarify it? And so there is binding precedent that either the Supreme Court can say, we agree with the Court of Appeals, or, you know what, we're going to take a different tact. And this is the tact that the approach that we're going to take.
Yes, Your Honor, I certainly take that statement. And as an advocate, I take it that slight half step further and say, hey, well, this could be an approval, actually, if we read the dicta. But I think that a precedential opinion doesn't need to issue from this court. I think we already have square authority that plaintiff, you have to have less fault than the person against whom you're seeking recovery from. I don't have a statute in the workers' compensation statutory scheme where a reduction would occur. So if in Fish, they discuss a 5% reduction that doesn't have authority from the workers' compensation law, that's a creature of our comparative fault scheme. To me, that would maybe, again, that would maybe signal that the Fish court, the Supreme Court, just this isn't a palatable change for them. Or perhaps, you know, if we are going to go up to another round in this case, that what I could see happening is that this is a legislative question. This is two different statutes coming into play, and let the legislature let us know and change their laws as they've done many times before, and codify common law such as Lambertson, which is now codified in the workers' compensation scheme. So my final point, and I am running a little low on time, but we're also seeking that this isn't sort of a back way of providing for aggregation of fault of multiple defendants. So to avoid the application of comparative fault, this court, I guess today we've found out, is very squarely being asked to write new law, or we're looking for something to happen to this 50% of fault that was attributed to Como Oil. Either that needs to be attributed to my client and aggregated to my client for fault purposes, obviously not for the contribution claim and how 60402, the formula works, but for fault and for who recovers and who wins, or that's it. That happens for the 50% fault that just gets attributed to my client, because otherwise we're looking at 45v5. And Judge Connolly, you mentioned, you know, looking at the numbers for this and comparing that to the Fish numbers, it's 5% of fault is very low. So we're thinking that my client paying for 55% of the verdict, despite only having 5% of the fault, if we had a case where the plaintiff's or the appellant's, excuse me, fault was less than that, we would be in Fish v. Ramler squarely. We would be in that type of formulaic world. In Hansen v. St. Paul Metro, this court, which is a 2000 decision, this court cited to Camburn, and it said that the plaintiff's fault is usually compared to each defendant rather than aggregated. So that case provides this court's analysis of aggregation. And then Fish v. Ramler, of course, prohibited the court from aggregating that fault or getting that credit. So There's no contribution analysis necessary in this case. Lambertson, Johnson, Hudson, Fish, all of those are squarely regarding contribution and the impact, the relationship between my client, Bill's Diesel, and Como Oil, the employer. But those holdings are almost irrelevant in the situation before this court is when a plaintiff is more at fault than the person they tried to sue, should they recover? Should they recover squarely because they are positioned as an employee tort plaintiff? That's pretty radical law. That would, I would be more comfortable with that coming from the legislature, but I understand we're at this intermediate level. So unless there's any other questions, I will wrap up. And we would just ask that you affirm what the district court did. It was a well-reasoned opinion. It took into consideration the clear statutory authority, the clear case law that's directly on point, and we would ask that you affirm.
Very much, Ms. Orcutt. Ms. Van Dyke, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you. I just want to address a few things that were stated because I think the outlines of what this case is about and what the plaintiff appellant is asking this court to do are pretty clear. Number one, the plain language of the statute, 60401. I would say, you know, we live with the interpretation of the word when we're talking about the fault greater than the fault of the person against whom recovery is sought in 60401. We live with the interpretation that that is a single person because a long time ago, the Minnesota Supreme Court looked to Wisconsin, adopt their interpretation and said, we're going to go this way. That case never, that was Mirror, and it's cited in my brief. That case never looked at the statutory language, even then. The statutory language, we have a rule of construction in Minnesota that says, and that is 645.08, that says the singular includes the plural. And the plural includes the singular. So it could be just as easily have happened at that time. If somebody had, you know, glasses that could see so far into the future, but if that law rule had been applied, there would have been some kind of discussion about, well, that means all the defendants. And there would have been what they call the unit rule, not aggregation per se, but the unit rule versus, you know, the group. All the persons. So plain language of the statute, frankly, I would argue that it doesn't particularly apply here. I'm not arguing to overrule Lines v. Ryan. What I'm saying is that these court employer-employee plaintiffs, the strict construction as it's been held in non-employment-related context, that portion maybe shouldn't be applied. And we're not talking about aggregation of fault in that sense. How could we? The employer doesn't have fault to the employee at all outside the comp system. That's why this whole thing is so sticky. The third party defendant is not in a position of being, inequitably treated. The whole contribution scheme as it was developed in Lambertson in a situation like this where they're 5% at fault and the employer is 50% at fault, they pay up front for their 5%. The plaintiff isn't going scot-free. And this hasn't been discussed, but the plaintiff's fault is being reduced. So that 45% is coming out of the damages. He's not recovering for something he did to himself. This 45% is gone. The remaining 55% for which he was not responsible, according to this jury, the 5% tortfeasor in this particular case, who looks like the picked on guy, but he's still 5% at fault. The plaintiff's eating his own fault. He has to pay upfront the 55%. That's inequitable. That's why there's contribution. He's able to go to the employer and get the employer to pay its 50% and easily get, if there's money, he's going to pay 5%, except in a big and large damages like this one, where that's going to get capped.
Ms. Van Dyke, I want to go back to your when you're looking at the language of 604.01 subdivision one, if the contributory fault was not greater than the fault of the person against whom the coverage is sought, and you're saying that the singular includes the plural and the plural includes the singular, but I have a couple of questions on that. One, it says the person, and so that does sound like the singular, but even if we accept your interpretation of the singular includes the plural, in this case, appellant sought recovery from one third-party tortfeasor. Mm-hmm. So even if you look at that as including the plural, there's no other party. So it doesn't seem to get you, at least in this case, where you want to go. And to the extent that it does include the plural, when we look to Hudson, as Judge Flory noted, there you had three third-party tortfeasors. And the case law is, from the Supreme Court is pretty clear that we look at each, compare the fault from the plaintiff to each individual tortfeasor. And so there, two were held liable, but the third, where the fault was less than the plaintiff, they were not held to be liable. So even looking at your interpretation of it, it still doesn't seem to, I don't know if your interpretation really gets there. It seems to be consistent with actually how case law has interpreted the statute already. So what's the difference?
The difference is that the statute was interpreted, if you look at how it was interpreted and in what context it was interpreted, it was done so in a non-workers' compensation setting.
Camburn was a workers, that was a, as you acknowledge in your reply brief, that actually was a workers.
Yes, it was.
So I'm not sure I follow that, you.
Let me see if I can make it more clear. This lawsuit is if you set aside the percentages right now, just look how the structure it's structured, because I think that goes to the root of your question. It's structured as if it were just a tort suit between my plaintiff against Bill's Diesel. If that were really the way things happened and we're inside the tort system completely there, if that's the reality of way things happened and we stayed just inside the tort system, and Rhines v. Lyon, which was a non-workers' comp case inside the tort system, workers' compensation wouldn't be brought in as a third-party defendant because they're not possibly liable at all. Then it would just be the way it was at original common law, plaintiff versus defendant, and even if someone else was responsible for 50%, as is true here, you'd end up with a situation where Bill's Diesel would pay the plaintiff, and then they'd have in a separate lawsuit go after whoever that third party was. The problem is this is not a pure tort system. And so right,
the case law does seem to recognize that and does seem to harmonize the two. It doesn't seem to be as large a conflict as you're creating, but I understand that's a position. So I'll leave it at that.
And I acknowledge that this is a sticky wicket. I had to do an amazing amount, and you have to, of reading and trying to draw out how this all works. And it still doesn't always work equitably for everybody. And my position here is that it needs to be as equitable to the plaintiff as it is to the employer and the third party tortfeasor. And that's not happening under this scenario. And that I think Fish changed the landscape. We just don't know how far. So I would advocate that we don't ask for a new trial. We've accepted the verdict despite how we got there. But that for the purposes of establishing liability, that it be overturned and returned to the district court with an order to, as outlined in my reply brief, so that I won't go and read it to you. I think I did a pretty straightforward job of saying the relief that was sought.
Thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. Thank you, Ms. Orcutt. The matter was very well argued.